It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Can you put a price on your family's best friend? While the relationship between you and your dog might feel priceless, how do you decide how much to spend on them for things like food, vet bills, doggy daycare? And how much value do they bring to your life? Can that be measured? In a new book, a Wisconsin author uses the tools of economics to understand the human-canine relationship. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How much do you spend on caring for your dog or dogs? Do you pay premium for the best food and care for your pet? Does having a dog increase your quality of life? How? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. David Weimer is the Edwin E. Witte Professor of Political Economy at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs. He's co-author of the new book, Dog Economics, Perspectives on Our Canine Relationships. Dave, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
I want to get this out there right up front. People might think, oh, no, an economist is going to come along and take all the fun out of dogs. You are a longtime dog companion. You like dogs, right?
I love dogs, and my co-authors had many, many dogs and raises them to be guides.
Now, there are a lot of books out there about dogs, the care of them, the history, sociology, things like that. Economic books about dogs. What led you to want to tackle that?
Well, it all began with a conversation with the economist at the Food and Drug Administration who has to do cost-benefit analyses of new regulations. So in 2007, there were a lot of dogs who died because of adulterated pet food. There was an ingredient from China that had been adulterated with melamine, and that resulted in several thousand pet dogs in the United States dying. So Congress gave the Food and Drug Administration authority to regulate pet food. But to do that, they have to write regulations, which requires them to justify the regulations with cost-benefit analyses. And the complaint was they knew how to value changes in human mortality risk, but they had no measure for dogs. So I took that as a challenge to come up with a measure using what we call stated preference methods. In other words, we survey people and through a survey experiment try to elicit their willingness to pay for mortality reductions for their dogs.
And that was where you started. And that illustrates, I think, one of the points of the book. It's about dogs, but it's also a window to learn economic concepts through our love of dogs.
Well, that's what we hope. We've written it so that if someone has had a little bit of prior exposure to economics, they should have no trouble. And we added a glossary for those who have had no prior exposure.
Now, an interesting thing that I hadn't thought of in this way until I read your book is we could think of a dog like any commodity, like a refrigerator, right? I'm going to figure out how much I want to pay, what features I want, what I don't want, things like that. Then I go out and make a decision. But obviously, I think obviously, the dog at our house is not a commodity or not just a commodity anymore. It has a very different meaning than my refrigerator or what have you. Can you talk about that strange role of a dog?
Yes, yes. One of the fascinating things from an economic perspective is dogs are both commodities and family members. Mm-hmm. About almost half of American households have dogs, and well over 80% of those households view dogs as family members. So you've got this strange commodity that's both something that can be bought, sold, owned, but yet people both consider their dogs family members often and act as if they consider them family members.
Now, I could imagine a very non-nuanced kind of economic approach saying, well, this is irrational. You're taking resources away from your human family members, spending them on this non-human household resident. You don't really get anything out of it. So it is irrational economically to be a dog owner. You put a little more nuance into the book.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it is expensive to be a dog owner in two ways. One is the monetary cost, which on average in the U.S. is about $1,500 a year. But there's also what economists call opportunity cost. So when you have a dog, your travel is more complicated, your schedule is more complicated. where you can live may be restricted. Even who your romantic partners are may be affected. So there are both monetary and opportunity costs. On the other hand, there are great benefits. We know the companionship benefit. That's obvious to people who have dogs. But there are all sorts of associated health benefits as well. Meeting your neighbors, so social capital. Mm-hmm. You have to walk your dog, so you get exercise that you might not otherwise have gotten. Just petting a dog can reduce stress. And then, of course, we have to balance that. Dogs can cause injuries. I know my wife's been pulled over a couple times when our dog was still a puppy and suffered some small injuries, and that can happen.
We are talking about the economics of dogs and our relationship with them. Dave Weimer is with us from UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs, co-author of the new book, Dog Economics, Perspectives on Our Canine Relationships. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest, or you can make a statement about the value of the dog in your life, in your family. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Those cost-benefit analyses you just mentioned changed a lot a few years ago, you write in the book, because of the COVID-19 pandemic and being at home a lot more. How did that shift our decisions about dogs?
Well, that changed the opportunity costs, right? If you were home, you didn't have to worry about how you were going to walk your dog and what was going to happen when your pup when you were away, if your puppy was going to eat everything in the house. And also, the value of the companionship was higher. We couldn't associate as freely with our friends and other people. So that changed the calculation considerably and resulted in a blip in ownership of dogs.
And there's concern, I know, anecdotally at least, that, well, did people who made those decisions in those unique conditions, now things are back to normal-ish. Have we seen people make the tough decision to give up dogs more?
Well, we are seeing it, and part of it is economic pressure. We are back to what had been the normal for quite a while. Every year, about 3 million dogs enter shelters for various reasons, and about 400,000 of them are euthanized. That's a large number of dogs. Initially, the initial fear of a surge didn't occur, but it's gradually gone back to where it was before the pandemic.
Now, you mentioned pet food regulation as one element where economics definitely plays into this. Another one is regulation of how animals are raised, so-called puppy mills here in Wisconsin, around the country. A lot of laws have come up over the years. An interesting thing there is the cost-benefit analysis of that kind of regulation changes depending on the value we place on dogs. And that, you write, treating them as just a form of property to something other than just property has really evolved over the years. Can you talk about that a little?
Yes. And the regulation of the creation of puppies is very complicated because there are very different sorts of providers. Mm. And many states have very good laws, but almost no states enforce them effectively. Inspections that nominally are supposed to occur every 6 months typically happen every few years in states like Wisconsin. Part of the problem from a political economy perspective also is the regulation tends to be housed in departments of agriculture, and their incentive is production. And production is not always the right thing for dogs, because dogs can be abused in the process, and excess puppies can be created that end up in shelters. So it's a very difficult area both to understand and to think about what kind of regulation would be effective.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Chris is with us in Belmont. Chris, hi.
Hi. You were talking about the economics, and we have a young dog, not quite two, hunting dog, that is very sick right now, and Doc thinks it's blastomyoma, that we spent close to $900 on a Tuesday, that if it would have been an older dog, like a couple of years ago, we had a couple that cancer, put them both down within 3 weeks of each other, that we would have put him down. But right now we're trying to save this dog's life because he's young and we love him very much. And he's going through a lot, and we would never do this to an older dog. And so I understand the cost effectiveness here. It's hard.
Chris, thank you so much for sharing that story. Best to your family and your dog. This is one of the toughest decisions that dog owners can have, Dave.
Yes, Chris. I mean, that is a really tough decision. And there is this question about what's best for the dog. It's a little bit similar to the problem we face when one of our relatives can no longer make health decisions, say because they have dementia or are in a coma or something, and we have to make a decision for them about what sort of care will be given. And I think norms have changed over time. The tendency we had with grandma was to spend whatever we can to save her, do whatever we can to extend her life. That used to not be the case with dogs. And I think increasingly it is, partly because dogs are more often viewed as really important family members. And many people now have health insurance, which makes it possible to spend more on end-of-life care. I think it's a very difficult question, what's best for the dog.
Chris, thanks for sharing that story, and good luck to you. We're talking to Dave Wymer, professor at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs, talking about his new book. He's the co-author. It's called Dog Economics, Perspectives on Our Canine Relationships. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How did you decide to get a dog if you have one right now? Did you factor in the initial cost, the ongoing costs, or did you just fall in love with a dog and go for it and hope for the best? Have you ever paid extra for a puppy of a particular breed? Did you adopt a dog during the COVID pandemic? What is the value to you of the dog in your life? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Dave Wymer from UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs. We're talking about his new book, Dog Economics, Perspectives on Our Canine Relationships. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about how economics applies to dog-human relationships? Do you pay for pet health insurance yourself? Has it come in handy? Do you spoil your dog, spend a lot of money and time and resources on it? Is that okay? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Eric is with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Eric.
Hey, how y'all doing?
Fine.
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, first of all, I want to make sure that people check out the breed of dog that fits their lifestyle. And then second, I want to know if the economist has taken into account the amount of treat we buy our dogs. Me and my neighbors both agree, whenever we go into a store, we're always looking at dog treats. My dog has more treats in the house than I do.
Eric, thanks a lot. Both great question. Now, you look in the book, Dave, at how people, we'll get to the treats in just a minute, but how people evaluate breeds and fitting their lifestyle, how much thought goes into that? Is it worth extra expense for particular breeds? Could you talk about the economics there?
Yeah, it's very interesting. Breeds do make a difference, but there's quite a bit of evidence that within breeds, there's a lot of individual variation. There's a study group collaborative called Darwin's Ark that collects survey data on people's dogs and then does genetic studies. And they find that there's a lot of genetic variation within breed, more than might be expected, and behaviors differ within breed more than might be expected. One of the interesting things from an economic perspective is that there seems to be fads in dog breeds. And there's some research that ties these fads to movies. Mm-hmm. So, for example, the original 101 Dalmatians led to a boost in the number of people who wanted Dalmatians as dogs, for example. And this has happened repeatedly. So partly breeds are fads. I think the Eric is correct that you should take account. I think that we have a standard poodle who's very strong, and probably if we were to get another dog, it would be a smaller poodle. So my wife wouldn't be pulled over when she's walking walking the poodle. So I think Eric is right. You want to think hard about what kind of dog to get. I think size is the most important feature, because there's so much variation in personality with inbreed.
Eric, thanks a lot for that call. Eric also mentioned treats. You've got a case study of liver treats and price setting in the book, but the economics of dog treats, it's a big deal. Eric doesn't have money for his own snacks, it sounds like.
Right. I sympathize with Eric. It's hard not to give your dog treats, and our dog now basically can only eat lamb-based food, and we've just discovered lamb hearts, and the dog goes crazy over them. It's like your kids, right? You want to give them treats, but you know that too many can be bad. So,
Eric, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to UW-Madison's Dave Weimer, co-author of the new book, Dog Economics, Perspectives on Our Canine Relationships. I want to look into the future a little bit, Dave, as you do in the last chapter of the book. Now, we're talking about breeds, right, and purebred and whatever. Well, now here comes genetic science. What are you watching for when it comes to, hey, maybe we can get that breed, but edit out some of the flaws that came from inbreeding? Or can we combine from different things to get the traits we want? A brave new world of dog decisions to make.
Yes, it is a brave new world. Clearly, genetic altering of breeding can be very powerful. However, we also now have some cloning going on. Mm-hmm. And you can imagine people thinking, well, if I could raise my kid again, would I do it differently? Well, with a dog, because of their shorter lifespans, you could imagine someone thinking, well, could I do better with that dog the next time?
Or even recreate that awesome experience with that dog.
Or recreate the same experience. That's right. That's right. So I think it is a brave new world.
And also, you are watching for maybe a continuing evolution. We talked earlier about, you know, our attitudes toward dogs changing from their property, do whatever you want with them, to they're more than property, and our customs and our laws and regulations changing over time. What are you watching for in the future?
Well, you know, if we look at the history, the anti-vivisectionists in England really started us off on avoiding cruelty to animals, and in particular dogs. And many states have adopted, most states, all the states actually, have adopted laws that prevent outright cruelty to animals. But end-of-life decisions are still left to the owner and, to some extent, veterinarians. And it'll be interesting to see if the professional norms within veterinary science change so that they will be less willing to euthanize, for example. That could pose some serious problems.
And I want to go, we've been looking at the future. Let's go back in time. You also use some economic concepts to examine why wolves started hanging out with people and became dogs. And there's a lot of tricky game theory here, but basically both sides were getting something out of it.
Yes. I mean, there were a few reasons wolves would hang around that weren't beneficial to people, like stealing game, right? But a lot of the other interactions that occurred were mutually beneficial. So providing warming to each other, aiding in hunting, a whole slew of other possible explanations. And originally, when I looked into this, I thought, oh, well, you know, evolution is so slow that how could we go quickly from a wolf to a dog? But there have been some experiments in Russia with foxes, and within six generations, they were able to breed foxes that behave like dogs.
Huh.
So the process could have been much faster than we might imagine.
Now, as we wrap up, Dave, there's a category of listener out there feeling really left out, and I'm talking about the cat people out there. I understand there may be a sequel in the works.
Well, not Not from us.
Oh, okay.
We're dog people. We're also a little bit seniors. So, but I think people would be interested in seeing a similar analysis for cats.
Mm-hmm. But that might be a very different equation, because we were just talking before the show. Cats came along much later in human terms as domesticated animals.
Yes, they probably came around when we started agriculture, helping us keep the rodents under control. So... whereas dogs are another maybe 5 or 10,000 years longer experience with humans.
And finally, you're hopeful, I think, that the dog economics book could be a bonus textbook for people teaching.
Well, I would hope so. Probably about half of the kids in their classes have had dogs or have dogs. And it'd be much more interesting than widgets.
Dave, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Been talking to David Wymer, professor of political economy at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs. We talked to him today about his new book. He's the co-author. It's called Dog Economics: Perspectives on Our Canine Relationships. There's still time for you to share your story of the value of the dog or dogs in your life. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. If we had a couple few good stories there, I could share them on the show tomorrow or maybe later next week. Again, email ideas@WPR.org with your dog story. Send pictures, too, while you're at it. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network on Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Salads aren't always thought of as comfort food. Sure, maybe you get an awesome sweet or savory dressing that makes the leafy contents more fun, or you load up enough croutons that it feels like you're eating a sandwich with extra crusty bread. What if salad was a luxurious and satisfying meal? The Seinfeld character Elaine knew what she wanted when it came to salads. Here she is talking to a waitress in a 1994 episode called The Big Salad.
How about a big salad? A big salad? You see?
Just tell her what you want. They'll make it for you.
It's a salad, only bigger, with lots of stuff in it.
I can bring you two small salads.
Could you put it in a big bowl?
We don't have big bowls.
All right, just give me a cup of decaf.
We have Sanka.
You could join in at 800-642-1234. Can salad be a meal for you? What goes into your salads? Are they the main event at your table? Or do you need some advice on making your salad bigger and more fun? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Kat Ashmore is the chef, recipe developer, and digital creator behind Kat Can Cook and the social media sensation of Hungry Lady Salads. Her new cookbook has those salads and a lot more. It's called Big Bites, wholesome, comforting recipes that are big on flavor, nourishment, and fun. Kat, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hello. So good to be here with you.
Now, before we dig into the salads, that's just one chapter we're going to focus on here, but tell us a little bit about your approach to food. What I'm reading, I like it. It seems like a lot of fun. Tell us about it.
I don't believe in either or. I believe in more. And what that means is I don't think that you should have to choose between eating tortilla chips or eating lettuce. I think you can do it all. And so my approach is really about abundant, flavorful, nourishing food that just happens to be good for you. But most importantly, it's delicious. And it's stuff that hopefully your families will all enjoy. I like to make one meal for my families at dinner time, and that's really important to me because I think as busy moms, we have enough to do. We don't need to be short order cooks.
And then reading through your recipe ingredients, I'm like, yeah, this is all pretty healthy stuff. But I think sometimes people think health food and it's like, what am I sacrificing? What am I leaving out? How much not fun am I going to have it? But your recipes, I'm looking at pictures of them. I'm looking at the final products. It sounds like really fun and satisfying.
They absolutely are. And, you know, my father used to say that you knew something was good for you because it didn't taste like anything. And so I took it as a personal challenge after culinary school to change his mind about that. And I think that my approach has served a lot of people really well because we are looking at adding a lot of stuff to our meals. We're building a ton of flavor. So anytime we're cutting back on the sugar or cutting back on the fat, we are putting in flavor. And so no one is going to feel like they are sacrificing anything with these recipes.
Now, your Hungry Lady Salad concept took off on TikTok, among other social media platforms. Could you talk about the origin of Hungry Lady Salads and how they got so big?
Oh, yeah. The Hungry Lady Salad. You know, I found myself, it was the first week of January in 2021, and I was kind of looking around. It was the new year, new you time where everyone is thinking about how can I drop a few pounds? How can I feel better in my clothes, have more energy, sleep better, all of those kinds of things. And it seemed to me that there were places to go if you wanted to be on a specific diet. Say you were paleo or keto, or you were practicing veganism. It was very obvious where you could go for those, that type of inspiration. And I found myself saying, but what about all of the people like me that just want to eat well, you know, that just want to eat better, that aren't going on a diet. They just want to eat better. So the Hungry Lady Salad was my answer to that. And it felt like a space that I was very ready and capable of stepping into. And these were big salads and are big salads that have a lot of stuff going on in them. They're going to keep you really satisfied throughout the afternoon. We're not talking about a piece of iceberg lettuce and a couple of old tomatoes. You know, these have a lot of layering, a lot of flavor, homemade dressings. And oftentimes you can meal prep them on a Sunday or a Monday and they will keep in the fridge all week.
Talking to Kat Ashmore. Her new cookbook is called Big Bites, Wholesome Comforting Recipes That Are Big on Flavor, Nourishment, and Fun. We're going to focus on salads and her concept of Hungry Lady Salads, a whole chapter in the book. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think of eating salad as a chore, a way just to get a little bit of green in that food? Or are you excited about salads? Do you put lots of cool stuff in them? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Kat, I will admit, you mentioned a homemade dressing that goes with all your salads here. I have this like weird mental block where I think, oh, homemade salad, that's super fancy and complicated. I know it isn't really. And in reading your recipes, that, you know, it would take like 30 seconds to make a lot of these dressings that you're making. Make the case for making our own dressings.
It makes all the difference in the world. I always say to people when they say, where should I start? I want to start cooking more in the kitchen. Where should I start? I say, make a salad dressing. That is something that is low effort, high reward every time. It's going to make dipping veggies into it more pleasurable. Oftentimes, you know, you can dunk everything from crispy chicken in there to pouring it over tacos or adding it to sandwiches as a spread. But really, it's utilizing the things that you already have on hand oftentimes, right? So great salad dressing, I look at it like a story. It's a cast of characters. Everyone is bringing out something else in the other characters involved, right? You've got spicy, sometimes sweet, salty, tangy, crunchy, acidic, and it all just works together.
You've shared a couple recipes with us. We've got them up at WPR.org/food. Let's check one out now. This one sounds great. Roasted cauliflower salad with sesame date dressing. You know, I like salad. I like roasted cauliflower. I don't really think about putting roasted cauliflower in a salad. Tell us about this recipe.
I love to hear that. That's usually what people say. Oh, wow. I never would have thought to do that. And that's what I love to do. I love to take ingredients and foods that are familiar, but just use them in a different way. So, you know, during the winter time, I think a lot of us still want to have those heartier dishes. And oftentimes that means components of the recipe that are cooked. So we have chickpeas in there for protein and fiber. We've got cauliflower that is roasted and caramelized. And then we've got the fresh green component. And the sesame date dressing is really, really spectacular. It's naturally sweetened with dates. You just whiz it all in a blender and you will impress yourself every time.
Now, I want to focus on something you mentioned earlier. You mentioned you're cooking for kids a lot. I'm a parent, and mostly my kids are pretty good about eating veggies, but there were some, you know, battles. How do your kids respond to these, you know, wild salads with all this stuff in them, including lots of veggies, obviously?
You know, it's hit or miss. Sometimes they will pick some stuff out of the salads and then just keep the stuff that they know that they like to eat, whether it's celery or cucumber or the lettuce, which I still consider a huge win. But I will tell you, sometimes I will make a salad dressing and a salad, and if they really like it, they will go back for 2-3 helpings of the salad. And I just turn to my husband and I say, I want every single family to experience this, because you know, nothing feels better than when your kid not only eats a nutritious meal, but goes back for second and third helpings.
Do you have you ever had the exact opposite experience? Because I've got, I mean, it's legendary. The day of I made celeriac slaw, you know, celery root.
Oh, yeah.
I found this recipe. Oh, yeah. I didn't even like it that much. This is the only food ever where my kids, it hit their tongue and they spat it right out. It was so, so bad. Have you ever had that big fail with the kids?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I have. Absolutely. I made a recipe last night, and William, my 7-year-old, his exact words to me were, "This is not your best work." Yes.
Oh,
not
wow.
Your best work. I know.
Is he watching cooking shows or something? That sounds like a bad review from not like Gordon Ramsay, but.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty hilarious. And he's like, I'm sorry. It's true. It's not your best work. And, you know, he was kind of right. It's a recipe that I'm testing for my next cookbook. And, you know, I always say, yes, I worked for Martha Stewart, but the hardest critics I've ever had are my kids.
All right. Let's get back into some salad ingredients. One tip, you've got some secret weapons that you have in the kitchen. One of them is one of my favorite, quick pickled red onions. For people who haven't done this, talk us through how to quick pickle a red onion and what we're going to do with it.
Oh, they're so good, aren't they? Yeah. They are just these secret weapons, I call them, are these little flavor bomb condiments that you have in the fridge that just add so much depth and flavor to anything you put them on. So they're really beautiful because we're using red onions. So you get that really pretty, like bright pink magenta color as they start to pickle. And you just do a really quick pickling brine, which has to have some kind of acid, a little bit of sugar, and then water at its most basic sense, some salt as well. I like to add pink peppercorn sometimes, some herbs, but you can keep it super simple. And then you just add that hot liquid that you have brought down a little bit to like a warm temperature to the onions. And then you just put them in your fridge and you give it some time and let them do their thing. And they will be really, really bright and tart and a little bit sweet. And they're great on everything from burgers to tacos to egg salad, scrambled eggs, you name it.
Kat Ashmore is with us sharing some of her best work. We're getting into the Hungry Lady salads and more from her new cookbook. That cookbook is called Big Bites, wholesome, comforting recipes that are big on flavor, nourishment, and fun. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest about how to make boring salads less boring? Are you a big salad fan yourself? Do you do salad as the meal ever? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. By the way, find a couple recipes from Kat at WPR.org/food. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Kat Ashmore, chef, recipe developer, and digital creator. We're talking about Kat's popular Hungry Lady salads. You can find those salads and more in her new cookbook called Big Bites, wholesome, comforting recipes that are big on flavor, nourishment, and fun. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Don is with us in Bayfield County. Hi there, Don.
Hey, Don here. Say, when I grew up, I'm 65 years old, and my parents never bought any salad dressing from the stores. They always make their homemade.
And did you have favorites you remember, Don?
Italian, mm-hmm. olive oil, vinegar.
Sounds great, Don. Thanks for sharing that. And a
you
good
have
salad
some
dressing.
Smart parents.
Yeah.
You have some smart parents.
And a salad dressing can be that easy, right? Olive oil, a little vinegar, maybe a little bit of spices, and you got yourself a dressing.
Yep. I think we tend to overcomplicate it. There's no need. I love it.
Thanks a lot for sharing that, Don. Jessica is with us now in Mauston. Jessica, hi.
Hi. How are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I'm just curious what her thoughts are on the keto diet. So I am 48. I am in early stages of menopause because of a hysterectomy. So I've been very strict on sugars and carbs, and I find it very hard to regulate my weight and still keep a healthy diet. I eat a lot of fruits, and what carbs I do eat are first thing in the morning. So I just like to hear her thoughts on that.
Jessica, thanks for the call. Now, Kat, you briefly mentioned keto, but saying your focus is not on a particular diet. I'm not that familiar with keto myself. Do you have thoughts on things that Jessica can do to make a keto diet, I don't know, more fun, interesting, tasty, and maybe still healthy?
I do. You know, I think that there are varying levels of these diet plans. So if you're doing strict keto, then that means no fruits, very little vegetables. I mean, it's almost bordering on the carnivore diet. It doesn't sound like that's the kind of thing you're following, which I think is great news. You know, ultimately, I think in order to be consistent with anything, you have to find a way to enjoy it. And like my recipes, for instance, you will find a lot of my recipes are low carb, not intending to be low carb, but just naturally low carb because of the fact that we are really celebrating a lot of produce, you know, beautiful vegetables. We're celebrating a lot of different kinds of proteins. So these recipes are more naturally low carb when they are low carb, but I think you're going to find that there is a ton of stuff that is still going to work for you.
Thanks a lot for the call, Jessica. And Kat, getting back to the philosophy of your, not just salads, but your whole cookbook, you're not saying I'm following one path and like these really strict rules. There's a lot of moderation, but there's a lot of room to play around with different stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, one of my salads, you're topping it. It's the barbecue ranch chopped salad, and you're topping it, I mean, not only with barbecued beans, but with tortilla chips. So it is truly not choosing between chips and salad. I mean, sometimes we're even eating them together.
Thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Kat Ashmore, her new book is called Big Bites, Wholesome, Comforting Recipes That Are Big on Flavor, Nourishment, and Fun. We're mainly focusing on the chapter about her hungry lady salads. Back to your calls. Mark is with us in Milwaukee. Mark, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up,
Mark?
Hi. I just tuned in, and I'm making a salad now, actually. I've been a vegan for 39 years, and so I make a salad pretty much every night. And I've been experimenting with, instead of using your normal store-bought dressing, I've been experimenting with putting things like cinnamon and just sprinkling water on top. But my key, I think, is to have the crunch in the salad. So I always throw beets in, peanuts, sunflower seeds, cucumbers, tomatoes, and all that stuff, raisins. And so a lot of my salad is not just the lettuce and spinach and whatever I throw in, but the crunchy stuff.
Mark, thanks a lot. Yeah, I love having, can't get enough of that crunchy stuff in salads, Kat. What are your other favorite crunch ingredients?
I agree. I'm big on the crunch, that's for sure. Well, I just mentioned tortilla chips, which is kind of fun, but it's not a staple. There are inherently crunchy vegetables, which I will add almost primarily for the sake of crunch, things like, you know, bell peppers or some celery or fennel or things like that. But I love to do toasted nuts. I think also using toasted walnuts in a salad dressing is really lovely. You just blend it in the blender with everything else and you've got a little bit of texture still. It's nice and creamy. Doing different kinds of seeds, absolutely. But even doing something like a savory granola or some crispy chickpeas that you just toss on a baking sheet with a little olive oil and salt. I can make pretty much anything crispy. I think crispy is a great texture to have in a salad.
Mark, thanks a lot for that call. Nancy joins us now in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi.
Hello, hello. I very much like the taste of sweet sour pickled beets. And I noticed that in the supermarkets, they cost quite a bit more than ordinary canned beets. So I'm wondering if I can buy the cheaper canned beets, pour off that liquid, and put on some kind of a brine to turn them into pickled beets. And do you have such a brine that I could very quickly make?
Well, and Nancy, let me, before we throw this to Kat, would you be open to, you know, buying beets, cutting them up and pickling them? That's how you can quick pickle those in the fridge. Oh, I think we lost Nancy. Okay, Kat, your thoughts on either converting canned beets or taking fresh beets and turning them into pickled beets?
I would say 100% you are going to be spending more money the more work that they are doing for you. So I would do a very similar brine as my pickled onions. That is a universal, you know, pickling brine. So as long as you've got some kind of vinegar in there, I usually just use a plain white wine vinegar. You can do apple cider and a little bit of sugar, a little bit of salt. You're going to be good to go. Water, of course. It's actually quite simple. Once you know how to pickle one vegetable, you know how to pickle them all.
Nancy, good luck to you. I'm nuts about pickled beets. So I'm right there with you, Nancy.
Yeah.
Rolf joins us now in Boyceville. Rolf, hello.
Hi there. I just wanted to comment on how a guy that has never cooked and does a salad once in a while.
Ooh,
what's your secret,
Ralph?
I take one head of romaine lettuce, chop it up on a cutting board until I can eat it with a spoon, and I take about 6 whole mushrooms, chop those up, put them on a dinner plate, and then I warm up 1 cup full of spicy hot chili and dump it on top, and I eat it.
Excellent. That's...
I love it. That sounds hearty.
Rolf, thanks for that. That's pretty outside the box, mixing chili into a salad, Kat. I don't know if I saw anything in exactly that neighborhood in your collection of salads.
Very creative. I mean, the closest thing would be the barbecue beans on the barbecue ranch chopped salad. So that's not too far away.
Thanks a lot, Rolf, for the call. Oh, I want to check out, before we run out of time, Kat, the other recipe you shared with us. We had that roasted cauliflower salad. Now we've got this shaved Caesar salad with fennel and, crispy chickpeas.
Yes, I love this one so much. It is very near and dear to my heart. I think everyone loves a Caesar salad. Almost everyone loves a Caesar salad. So I knew that I had to have a rendition of a Caesar salad in here. The fennel adds some nice crunch. It adds a little bit of that anise flavor, which kind of just makes it feel a little bit more sophisticated. And then the crispy chickpeas are a brilliant way to get a bit of crunch and to get some protein if you don't want to add something like chicken. Though, honestly, you could just throw chicken on this as well, too, and it would be delightful.
Now, just our last few moments, Kat, I know you're constantly experimenting with new recipes. What is in your laboratory right now?
Oh, so at the moment, I am working on, I'm calling it an Italian stuffed cabbage soup. So it's got lots of ground beef and garlic and tomatoes and rice and cabbage and Parmesan. It's really, really hearty and really delicious. I think that'll probably be in my next book.
Excellent, Kat. We'll talk to you again when that comes out. Thanks so much for joining us.
Sounds great. Loved being with you. Thank you.
That's Kat Ashmore, the chef, recipe developer, and digital creator behind Kat Can Cook. And we talked to her today on this week's edition about hungry lady salads that come from her new cookbook. It's called Big Bites. Wholesome, comforting recipes that are big on flavor, nourishment, and fun. You can find 2 of those salads at WPR.org/food. The shaved Caesar salad with fennel and crispy chickpeas we were just talking about, plus the roasted cauliflower salad with sesame date dressing. Again, find those at WPR.org/food. And if you have any favorite salad secrets to share, you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we hear from the author of the new book, The Other Significant Others, Reimagining Life with Friendship at the Center. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about being seen.
What's one of the best ways to combat hate? For Jesus Gregorio Smith of Appleton, it's to push back with love. He shares his story as part of the Home is Here project, which amplifies the voices of the growing number of Black, Asian, Native American, and Latino residents who call northeastern Wisconsin home.
I saw the sign up on Richmond Street in downtown Appleton, and I couldn't believe my eyes. It was just a sign flashing the F word, the one that rhymes with maggots. It was displayed across a business sign so everyone driving down the road could see it like it was nothing. All I could think about was, how could this be possible? Those poor queer kids who already have a hard time with family, within themselves being gay or bi or trans, what happens when they see this sign spewing so much hate? I had to do something. I've experienced my fair share of hatred and bigotry throughout my life. I was born and raised in the little old town of El Paso, Texas. My father, Johnny Smith, is an African-American man who was born in the 1940s during legal segregation. While Dad was stationed at Fort Bliss, he traveled to Juarez, Mexico, with his fellow soldiers for drinks and fun nights. It's there he fell in love with my mother, Sonia Smith. Once they were married, they had 5 mixed-race children. I'm the youngest of the 5. I had the luxury and honor of having 2 cultural backgrounds and influences in my life. But that luxury also had costs. I recall the first time I was ever called the N-word, and it was by Mexican folks. And I thought to myself, don't we all have it bad enough? Why are we picking on each other? I'll never forget the time my mother gave me this serious talk in first grade because she was embarrassed with how feminine I was as a child. In fact, the first person to ever call me the F word was my mother. My father instilled a particular vision of Black masculinity that was meant to protect my brothers and I in the world. He stressed that I needed to get a good job in computers in order to be successful. As I got older, I hid my gayness and only pursued paths that would make my family proud, keep me hidden, and keep the comments about me to a minimum. But college didn't lead to a career in computers. Instead, I faced my fears and embraced my identity. I began empowering fellow members of the queer LGBTQIA community. Eventually, I got my PhD in sociology with a focus on race, sexuality, and masculinity. And that's what brought me to Wisconsin, a job at Appleton's Lawrence University as an assistant professor of ethnic studies. Which brings me back to that homophobic sign I saw in downtown Appleton. I didn't let the hate deter me. So when I decided to protest under the sign, I gated up even more to be exactly what the sign said I was. I put on a purple wig, a rainbow shirt, white high heels, and danced around to Born This Way by Lady Gaga. I filmed a silly video and took a photo. The photo went viral on social media. Not too long after, numerous Appleton residents showed up to fight against the hate, resulting in it coming down. I took that viral image, put it on a shirt, and sold it, and raised $15,000 for the Sexual Assault Crisis Center. That is how you turn that hate into love. Through the process of finding oneself, embracing oneself, living as one's authentic self, one can counter painful experiences and turn them into something different. I tried to hide myself from pain, but when I bravely faced it, I overcame it. It isn't easy, but I think we deserve to see a different world. Determining your own path, despite what others say, can help you break out of molds that confine you. I eventually embraced who I was and made a huge difference in people's lives, as well as my own.
Jesus Gregorio Smith is an associate professor of ethnic studies at Lawrence University. His story is part of the Home is Here project from the New News Lab, a local news collaboration in northeastern Wisconsin made of six media organizations, including WPR and the Green Bay Press Gazette. More information can be found at wisconsinlife.org. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCullum.
This is Central Time. Do you remember when you were a kid and maybe your best friend was the most important person in the world? Here's Maya Erskine and Anna Conkle in the show Pen 15 playing middle school versions of themselves, imagining what life would be like when they're grown up.
We share a dorm after school.
Yes.
Okay? And I cook you all of your lunches.
Oh, yeah. And I cook breakfast, dinners, and snacks.
Because you're the only one who knows how I like my onions to be cooked.
I knew you were going to say onion sautéed. Yeah, and we're going to have a double wedding.
Yeah. And then we'll probably get divorced at the same time.
Because they got in the way of us.
Yeah. And then we'll probably have kids like a couple years apart so that you can help me raise mine because I'm going to have issues with it.
And we can live on the same property, right?
Yeah. And then when you get sick, I'm going to take you to the doctor every day because it's a block away, okay?
Why don't friends grow up and live together? Maybe have a family together or take care of each other when they get older? Why isn't friendship at the center of life? Well, sometimes it is. Our next guest writes about friends who have chosen to live their lives together in ways that break a lot of the unspoken rules about American friendship, and in a way that runs up against the assumption that a romantic relationship should be the center of our lives. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had or do you have a friendship like this that's as important to you, maybe more important than a romantic partnership? Have you felt a friendship get demoted when somebody has that romantic relationship? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Raina Cohen is producer and editor for the NPR podcast Embedded. She's the author of The Other Significant Others, Reimagining Life with Friendship at the Center. Raina, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for being here, and I love that clip at the top.
It was credit to the producer on that one. I didn't find it. Now, you've experienced friendships like this, and you kept finding people who had these intense friendships, and it seems like everybody felt kind of alone and odd ducks, but it's more common than we might think. Tell us of what you set off to find in this book.
I had personal experience in a friendship like this that felt like best friend didn't even cut it as a label, where my friend and I were really enmeshed in each other's lives in a way that wasn't so different from the romantic partnership I've been in concurrently. And I wanted to find other people who had this kind of friendship because I knew that we were not the only ones and that there was something fundamentally challenged by these friendships in terms of the hierarchies of relationships, in terms of the emotions and the kind of commitment we're told we're only supposed to experience in romantic relationships, or you can only form families through romantic relationships. And I found people who are of all different ages and political persuasions and genders who have exactly this kind of friendship. And one of the remarkable things of those stories and what I've heard since the book has come out is everybody feels like they're isolated and nobody gets these friendships, and yet so many people have them.
And before we meet some of the people you profile in the book, a common theme again is that they have a hard time explaining it. We don't necessarily have the language for it. If we look to pop culture, the happy ending is always that romantic relationship. How did we downgrade this possibility of this intimate, passionate, productive friendship in favor of romantic relationships to such a huge degree?
It certainly was not always this way, that a romantic partner was supposed to be the be-all and end-all and be your everything. Just in the last 50 years, we've gone from thinking you were supposed to have love be the core part of your relationship and maybe companionship, to also reaching the highest heights of yourself and having a person help you, you know, figure out the best version of yourself and be your best friend, which doesn't obviously leave very much room for a best friend if your romantic partner is taking that role. If you look back even further, a couple hundred years ago, and we can go way, way back, the expectation was that a spouse was really providing a kind of practical role, that marriage would be merging families, would be more like an economic contract that was about the resources that two people and their families can exchange. So a lot of people found the most emotional intimacy in their friendships, which makes a lot of sense when, you know, the marriage wasn't expected to fill that role. And also there was such an inequality between men and women that it's kind of hard to have an egalitarian relationship like friendship, or an egalitarian relationship in a marriage, really, if you're not equals to one another. But you can find that equality more in friendship.
I want to meet a couple of the people you talk to. Andrew and his friend, Toli, couple of guys, they end up describing each other, I think, as a platonic life partners. Can you tell us a little bit about their story?
Yeah, they were a couple of the first people I talked to. They are now in their 30s, and they met when they were in high school and just became part of a friend group eventually. There were three of them who were really close, Andrew, Toli, and their friend David. And as they went off to college, David ended up dying by suicide. And Andrew and Toli were really there for each other during this massive period of grief, and also trying to help David through all his mental health challenges up until then. And that, you know, was one thing that kind of cemented the friendship. But they have gone on to make major life decisions around one another. They have moved across, one has moved across the country for the other. They've oriented their careers so that they can be living and working in close proximity. They created a nonprofit together. And they've also run into issues with romantic partners because people don't understand how a friendship could be as significant as it is, and that the women that they've dated often hit a point where they don't feel comfortable not being absolutely the number one person in their life. So they, you know, at a time in their lives, in their, you know, 20s and 30s, when everyone around them was saying you should kind of build your life around a romantic relationship, they decided to do something different, and often kind of ended up really confusing people and getting judgment from people, and people wondering, was it actually a sexual relationship? They just couldn't compute that it was a friendship.
Raina Cohen is with us, author of the new book, The Other Significant Others, Reimagining Life with Friendship at the Center. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have that kind of special long-term friendship with someone that equals or exceeds maybe a romantic partnership in your life? Do you have questions for our guest about some of the things she found? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Raina Cohen about her new book, The Other Significant Others, Reimagining Life with Friendship at the Center. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What role have friends played in your life? Do you have that friend who's before all others? Maybe more important relationship than a spouse or significant other. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller. Nick is with us in Beloit. Nick, hi.
Hey, I had a bit of a question about this. So I know a lot of people spend time at work, and in the recent years, people have been talking a lot about the idea of a work wife or work husband. Is this kind of the same thing, or is it just a shade of what you're discussing here?
Nick, thanks for the call. I think people may mean a different levels, Raina, of a commitment when it comes to that work wife or work husband, but that idea of someone else in life providing emotional connection in addition to what someone might get in, say, a marriage or other significant relationship, I don't know. It seems like it parallels at least some of what you write about.
And there's definitely overlap. You know, I think one example of somebody who would have been maybe like work husbands to each other are these, well, actually Andrew and Tolly, who I described in many ways are like work husbands to one another. They worked in the same physics lab for a while. They are doing the same, you know, working in the same place right now. They started a nonprofit, as I mentioned. So, I think what takes this to a slightly different level might be that it's not just in a workplace setting that these people have these really close bonds, but that they're also, you know, making decisions to live with or near each other, to maybe raise kids together, to look toward a shared future is really the way that I would define the sorts of friendships or platonic partnerships, as I call them in the book. But I think anybody who's experienced a platonic relationship of real intensity can relate to the way that these friends connect with one another.
Thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. Another pair that you write about, Barb and Inez, I'm sorry if I'm pronouncing that name wrong.
Yeah.
Inez, yeah. They end up later in life moving in together. Can you tell us a little bit about their story?
Yeah, I love the two of them. So I met them the house that they share in the suburbs of St. Louis, and they've been best friends for 50 years, and they've supported each other in all sorts of ways, including when Inez got divorced from her husband, and she has two children, and Barb is very involved in taking care of the kids. And when the two of them were on the cusp of retirement, Barb wanted to move back to St. Louis from where they'd been living in Arizona. And Inez decided to follow, and they wanted to buy their own homes that were maybe next door or really close proximity, but they couldn't afford it. And what they eventually decided to do was to buy a home together. And now they, you know, are roommates or housemates, and they have been for 25 years. And it has been a great source of companionship and comfort and care. They, do their grocery shopping together. They go to the same primary care doctor. They do a lot of volunteering together. They're really inseparable in a lot of ways, though they have a wider community around them.
A theme that comes up a lot is, you know, some people that you write about, they are the main relationship in each other's lives. But in many cases, there might be a romantic partner, significant other, whatever, and this long-term friendship. And it seems like almost a cliche, all right? Well, yes, you've got this close friend, but now you're getting married or committed in some way. So it's time to downgrade that friendship. It's not as big a deal anymore. How have people worked around that? How have people solved it so they can have both of those great relationships?
You know, lots of people run into problems with some partners, you know, romantic partners who don't feel comfortable with the friendship, are suspicious of it, or just want more space in their romantic partner's life. But for the ones where it does work, there's usually some understanding on the side of the romantic partner that there's a benefit to be had, that not relying on your romantic partner for everything actually can make the relationship stronger. And what I found in the cases of Andrew and in another story that I tell, both of them had issues previously with, you know, other partners getting them on board, but then they found somebody who themselves had really close friendships or a sense of chosen family. And they, you know, had experienced for themselves how nourishing a friendship can be, and that they also did not want to cut off ties to their friends or downgrade their friends in order to be part of the romantic relationship. So it was sort of finding somebody who had some awareness of how deep the friendship can be and how there could be this sort of multiplier effect where the friendships enrich the romantic relationships and vice versa.
Talking to Raina Cohen, author of the new book, The Other Significant Others, Reimagining Life with Friendship at the Center. Back to your calls with Cortland in Madison. Cortland, hi. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I just had been listening to your program here and listened to a few of the situations. And I thought, you know, I've got a friend of mine that, shucks, we've been friends for 25 years. And we're friends before both of us were married. We're both heterosexual. We both love our wives and we love our families. And yet I imagine if we would talk about it, you know, I think that we're probably, our friendship together is closer than my friendship to my wife and his friendship to his wife. I mean, like I say, we love our wives and we love our children, but And so, yeah, that it's just maybe a little bit different than what you've spoken about. But, yeah, I can understand how these people have relationships that, you know, their friendships are closer than their romantic relationships.
Cortland, thank you so much for sharing that with us. And, Raina, I think a lot of guys, straight guys, wouldn't necessarily express this in that way, that this is a closer relationship in some ways even than their spouses. Your thoughts on Cortland's story?
Yeah, I mean, I love hearing it. And if you're looking at the stats on this, yes, it is much more rare for men to say that they feel more emotional intimacy with their male friends than they do with their female spouses. And the reverse is true for heterosexual women. And, you know, in terms of, if you've heard the term, the friendship recession, that there is a decline in the number of friends and close friends Americans have, men are really faring a lot worse on this measure. But, you know, that's not the case for every single person. What I found interesting and you know, what Cortland was saying is that there is a need to almost justify or really make clear, like, I love my wife, but I also love my friend, and that there's some way at this point that it's almost like an affront to say that you care for a friend or feel as closer to a friend than you do a spouse. But a lot of people feel that way, and it also, you know, you don't have to be best friends with your spouse. You can have a best friend, or you can have many close friends, and you know, again, these things can enrich each other and not detract.
Thanks for that call, Raina. Just in our last less than a minute, what would you say to someone who feels what you're talking about and doesn't know how to tell other people in their life, doesn't know how to put it into words?
You know, I think it helps to look at models that are out there, which could be the nonfiction models and like the ones that I'm describing, or looking out into pop culture at, you know, the protagonists in Scrubs, the women in Broad City, those TV shows, and say, you know, if you've seen that and you understand that, that's the kind of friendship that I have.
Raina, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on and for the callers, too.
That's Raina Cohen, producer and editor for the NPR podcast Embedded. She talked to us today about her new book. It's called The Other Significant Others, Reimagining Life with Friendship at the Center. Hey, still time for you to share your story. If you have one that fits the theme, you can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network on Wisconsin Public Radio.